I'd like to issue a public warning at the beginning of this sermon. This is a highly theological sermon. This is a highly philosophical sermon. This is a deeply historical sermon. It's a little bit difficult, but we do have the miracle of modern technology. If you so desire, you can listen to this again and try to pick up anything you might have missed on. I will try to make everything as clear as possible, but I do admit this is a dense one. It's a tough one. You have been so warned. In the Old Testament lesson today, we heard the famous words of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, the laws that flow out of the direct character of the triune God. That's what the Decalogue is. They are laws that flow out of the direct character of the triune God. I was blessed a few months back in this last spring to spend the afternoon at a pub in Philadelphia with my father, with Reverend Billy Spanger, and our good friend, the world-class systematic theologian, Lane Tipton, maybe the country's greatest living systematic theologian. He really is a surgeon when it comes to systematics. He is studied. He is measured. He is careful. He's precise. But as a theological surgeon, he's also looking for people to cut. He's always looking for a fight. Or maybe more accurately, he's always looking to defend orthodoxy, and sometimes that requires throwing some theological haymakers. Well, our conversation that day, for some while, it got redirected to the talking about the second commandment. After all, that's kind of what pubs were made for, beers and systematic theology. So the second commandment took up a sizable amount of our time that day. I'd like to read for you the words of the second commandment from Exodus 20. Hear these words anew, afresh, as they come out of the direct divine character of God. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. The second commandment, it gets a sizable amount of text in the Exodus 20 account, especially in comparison to many other commandments, like you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. It's interesting, the second commandment gets all of this time, all this text. Well, there are many things to say about the second commandment, but for our purpose and in relation to our text, Mark chapter 12, it's important to see how the second commandment is a beautiful safeguard against an overrealized eschatology. The second commandment is a beautiful safeguard against an overrealized eschatology. Now, that might seem like some cumbersome theological terminology. Really? An overrealized eschatology? It's 9:30. It's early today. What do you mean? Well, maybe, after sitting under the preaching of my father for some time, maybe that's not that difficult for many of you. Maybe you're quite familiar with what it means to have an overrealized eschatology. An overrealized eschatology, it has to deal with this already not yet dynamic of the kingdom. This already yet, not yet dynamic of the Christian life, of Christianity as a whole. We live in this constant and perpetual tension between what we already have in Christ and what we do not yet have. We are already fully righteous, not yet fully sanctified. We have already died with Christ, though we have not yet died. We have already gained resurrection victory, and yet resurrection victory in its final form has not come to us. There is always this tension between what we already have and what is not yet consummated. So an overrealized eschatology, what it does is it oversells and it overemphasizes what will be ours as if we already have it now. Right, that's the definition of it. An overrealized eschatology oversells, overemphasizes the things that will be ours as if we already can have them now. It pulls future realities, heavenly realities, from the vertical, and it drags them down into the horizontal. And this can be a very dangerous thing, this overrealized eschatology. Now, I just made the claim a second ago that the second commandment is a beautiful safeguard against an overrealized eschatology. But I have not told you how so. In what way is the second commandment a safeguard against having an overrealized eschatology? Well, the second commandment tells us we don't want images of God. And we don't want images of God because God is a spirit. And we don't have the mental capacity to envision a spirit. So we can't make images of God. That's simple enough. But we don't even want our minds overpopulated with the earthly image of Christ because, beloved, no such Christ exists. No such Christ exists. Yes, Christ remains man, but we have no biblical descriptions of him. We get some, maybe, some physical description of Christ in Isaiah, but I'm not even sure we can call it a physical description. Because what Isaiah does is he gives us a theologically apophatic description. It's another tough term there. But it's a good one to add to your vocabulary. Isaiah gives us a theologically apophatic description. And an apophatic description is a description by negation. I'll give you an example. If someone comes up to me and asks me what my wife looks like, and I say, well, she doesn't look like that woman, and she doesn't look like that girl over there, and she doesn't look like this, that would be an apophatic description of her. How does Isaiah describe Christ? This is what Isaiah says. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Not a lot you can do with that. Try and draw a picture of that real quick. If you're doing one of those police sketches of the criminal, and he's asking for information, he's like, all right, what did he look like? No form or majesty, no beauty that we should desire him. How do you draw a picture of that? I think it's really telling, and it speaks to the unsurpassable wisdom of God as displayed in the second commandment, that the only New Testament descriptions that were given of Jesus, they are descriptions of Jesus in his futurely eschatological glory. There is no physical descriptions of Jesus in his pure humanity. It's Jesus in his eschatologically glorified humanity. We see him described on the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew 17. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. I don't know about you, but that doesn't exactly sound like the Chosen's Jonathan Rumi to me. Not exactly. John gives us a physical description of Jesus as well in Revelation chapter 1. You just heard it read. But yet again, it's a physical description of Christ in his future eschatological glory. This is how John describes Jesus. And in the midst of the Lamb stands one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held the seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. And his face was like the sun, shining in full strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Be honest with yourself. When somebody says, what does Jesus look like? Is that what you picture? Is that what you picture? Or do you picture something like Jonathan Rumi? Making images of Christ is the result of, leads to, or at least goes hand in hand with an overrealized eschatology. It is ripping of Christ out of heaven and bringing him down to earth. Think about our brothers and our sisters in the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church for a moment. With all of their icons, their statues, their crucifixes, It's as if in their worship, they bring us to a place that very much can be touched. When you come to worship, you can touch it. You can see it. But what do we come to in worship? What does the author of Hebrews tell us that we have come to? He says, you have not come to Mount Sinai, a place that can be touched with hands, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to innumerable angels in festal gathering. You've come to the assembly of the firstborn who are enthroned in heaven. You've come to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. That's what you have come to right now. We ascend in worship to the heavenly realm, to where our true citizenship is. We do not rip heaven down to us. That's why we say the sursum corda. We lift up our hearts. We don't tear Christ's heart down to meet us here. And this overrealized eschatology, that is at least at part and due to our misuse or abuse of the second commandment, it doesn't just affect the use of images. What does Rome do? What does the Roman Catholic Church do in the practice, the belief, the teaching of transubstantiation? The teaching that at the Lord's Supper, those elements of bread and wine are really and truly transformed into the physical body and blood of Christ. What are they doing? They're ripping Christ out of heaven. We ascend in the Spirit to be with him. They bring him down to us. It's really no wonder that the Roman Catholic Church has been so very comfortable building earthly cities. Getting the second commandment wrong can lead to all sorts of mischief. It can lead to the missing the blunt edge of Jesus' words that we heard last week when he says, "My kingdom is not of this world." But for large swaths of Christians, the kingdom of Christ is intensely and primarily of this world. At least they talk and they live as if such is the case. Did any of you know that there was a medieval Catholic theory that every island on earth belonged to the Holy See? Every island on earth belonged, that is to say, belonged to papal jurisdiction. The Pope owned every island on the earth, according to this medieval theory. And as such, there were large efforts made in the early modern era to define the Americas as an archipelago. As such, if we could define the Americas as an archipelago, it would be run by the Pope. Because the Pope, the Roman Catholic Church, had a right to every island. Christopher Columbus, he even sent a letter to the King Ferdinand of Spain in 1493, titled "Epistle on the Island Recently Discovered." Epistle on the Island Recently Discovered. That island being all of the Americas. Political theology is a dangerous game to play. That is to say, mixing and commingling theology and local politics is often a disastrous cocktail. And beloved, from our inception, here as Americans, from the Puritans on, there has been a very dangerous political theology running in the bones of Christians. For the most part, it's latent, it's hidden, but we have inherited it, and even latent, it can still be quite dangerous. You'll notice this, how closely so many Christians have their God and their country commingled together. In 1513, a very important political philosopher by the name of Niccolo Machiavelli, I'm sure you've heard of Machiavellianism before, Niccolo Machiavelli wrote one of the most influential books in the history of the world. It's the high point of Renaissance literature. 1513, Machiavelli writes The Prince. And in The Prince, towards the back end of The Prince, and I love teaching The Prince, Machiavelli, he writes an exhortation to this man by the name of Lorenzo de' Medici. And if you know the Medici family, they're a very, very influential family in medieval and Renaissance Europe. extraordinarily wealthy family. And Machiavelli writes his exhortation to Lorenzo de' Medici. And he says, Lorenzo, I think you are going to be a great unifying force for all the Italians. And he lists three reasons why. He says, these are the three reasons why, Machiavelli, you will unify Italy. He says, number one, the sea has parted for you. Number two, a pillar of fire has led you on your way. And number three, manna has fallen from the sky for you. A sea has parted for you. A pillar of fire has led you on your way. Manna has fallen from the sky for you. What is Machiavelli telling Lorenzo? He's saying, you are God's special chosen leader. And that would make the Italians God's special chosen people. And anyone who is not the Italians then has the unfortunate situation of being the Canaanites. It's a very, very dangerous idea. And from 1513 on, with Machiavelli's The Prince, this idea of individual nations thinking that they are the special chosen people of God, boom, it takes off like wildfire. You see it in the bones of the Russian people, right? You hear them talking about Mother Russia, right? And those ideas are inculcated in guys like Hegel, who then passes it down to Marx. And the Germans would come along and say, the Germans are God's special chosen people. And history will reach its end, its culminating purpose in the German people. Well, from Machiavelli on, this idea becomes very, very prevalent in our American history. Many of the early settlers to America, they viewed their story as one that very closely mirrored the story of the Israelites. If you think about the Israelites are enslaved by a mighty empire. And what were many of the early settlers to America? They were enslaved by a mighty empire, England. Israel had to be led out of Egypt, that mighty empire, across a body of water. Interesting. We Puritans, we Christians, fleeing for religious reasons, had to be come to a new place through a body of water. And the Israelites, they left Egypt and they were led to the Promised Land. And many of the early settlers called America the Promised Land. Even in their letters, they referred to it as New Canaan. New Canaan. For many of the early American settlers, and for many of our founders, these parallels between Israel's history and America's, they were too numerous, too precise to just be accidental. An early founder of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, a man by the name of Edward Johnson, he spoke of the founding of New England in terms of Israel rebuilding the temple. The founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony is Israel rebuilding the temple? That is a grossly misappropriate use of the biblical text. Unfortunately, this isn't just a one-off in regards to our country's history, to our country's history with political theology. In 1776, just before the Continental Congress concluded its business that they were going to do on July 4th, we all know what happened on July 4th, a couple of really important men get together. You might be familiar with them. John Adams, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and a few others. And they sat down and they had plans to design a seal that would be the seal for our new nation, the United States. This is their proposal. A seal that has the words, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Okay. That motto, it would be set against an image of Moses dressed as the high priest. So America's seal would be Moses as the high priest. And Moses would be standing on the banks of the Atlantic shore, where he had his hands extended, causing the sea to peel back and overwhelm Pharaoh, who's in the background of the seal, sitting in an open chariot with a crown on his head. Rays from a pillar of fire in the clouds shine down on Moses, expressing that he acts by the command of the deity. God's special chosen people, the Americans. Yikes. This stuff is in our bones as Americans. Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, he wrote these words, and I quote, "We Americans are the peculiar chosen people, the Israel of our time. We bear the ark of the liberties of the world." As Americans, we spend a lot of time worried about Caesars, don't we? We're really worried about our Caesars. The kingdoms of this world and our relations to them is of utmost priority for us. We are ever so worried about them extending their reach, overstepping their bounds, trampling our liberties. And then we hear the words of Jesus in our text today. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not? But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God." And they marveled at him. Yeah, I think that's a political bombshell that merits some marveling. Now, taxation from the Leviathan state, that's a real problem. That's an ever-present problem. And it's a real problem that didn't just exist in the ancient past. It doesn't just exist in the world of Robin Hood. But dealing with overtaxation by the state, it can be acutely felt by each and every person in this room right now. All of you paying astronomical sums, most of the time against your will, to fund and enlarge all sorts of institutions that most of us don't support. I'm not going to lie. I see a taxation is theft flag flying, and I get a little fire in my belly. My libertarian streak comes out. I get excited, and for a moment, that is the number one priority in my heart. Now, the Jews, they were God's people. And not only that, they were supposed to be his liberated people, his free people. But that was no longer true when we get to our text. Ever since the Babylonian invasion, almost 600 years before this event, 600 years before the conversation here with Jesus, they had been under the thumb of a foreign power. The Jews had been ruled over. And guess what? When you're ruled over, you're taxed. And that's frustrating. But these coins themselves, would be more than a source of frustration. These coins, they would be an affront to the Jewish people. These coins, you can go look at them. We still have some of them. The Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, he would preen out from the middle of the coin. And the coin would say these words on it: "August Tiberius, son of the divine Augustus." Son of the divine, the August one. That means here's the one with supreme authority. Here's the one with majesty. Here's the one with the highest dignity. That's on the coins that the Jews would hold. That would rankle them a little bit, wouldn't it? And it gets worse than that. Do you know what it would say on the back of these coins? High priest. High priest. And you might be saying, why would it say high priest? Because for the Romans, the state and the cult, the state and the religion are one and the same. Do you know that the early Christians were accused of being atheists? The early Christians were accused of being atheists. My church history students are always rightly, justifiably surprised by this. They say, how could Christians be accused of being atheists? Well, I'll try to explain by quoting someone far brighter than myself. In a monumental book filled with a truly stunning level of scholarship and research, the book's called The Innocence of Pontius Pilate, philosopher and historian David Lloyd Dusenbury writes this. If you turn to page 5, you'll see this quote in the back of your bulletin. Follow along with me. This is what Dusenbury writes. "It is for political reasons, or rather for theological political reasons, that the first generations of Christians were perceived as atheists. The religion of Rome belonged to the city to its religion. Because of this, atheism is not a crime of conscience in a Greco-Roman milieu. It is a threat of revolution. The church is a cabal that subverts the Roman temple state. For Rome, the church and the state are so uniquely one that to reject anything of the state is to reject the religion. It's to reject God and so be considered an atheist. So here in our text, here stands Jesus, the true king, the true priest, standing near the temple, and he's handed some coinage that has another man's face on it. A man who was made in his image. A jar of clay claiming to be the king, the august one, the majestic one, the divine one, and also claiming to be the high priest. Think about that. The irony could not be thicker. It couldn't be richer. Man who is made in God's image on the coin that's brought to Jesus. And here, as we saw previously in Mark's gospel, the Pharisees and the Herodians, they're working together and they intend to trap Jesus. Verse 13 of our text says, "And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk." Well, what's the trap? Well, the trap is like this. One, if he accepts the tax, then he's going to tick off all the Jews. He's openly going to accept the blasphemy of Caesar calling himself divine. Is Jesus going to openly accept the fact that Caesar is saying, "I'm the high priest"? Can't do that. Or two, he can reject the tax and then be reported to Pontius Pilate as one who is inciting political revolt. It is a classic catch-22 for Jesus. Now, Jesus, as we have seen time and time again throughout the Gospels, Jesus is most certainly a revolutionary. I want you to hear that. Jesus is a revolutionary. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. But he is leading a very different kind of revolt. So the revolutionary actions, the fighting back against the state, it looks a little bit different. As we heard last week and again today, John 18:36, "My kingdom's not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from the world." So how does Jesus respond? He responds in a politically and theologically brilliant and ambiguous way. He first asks for a coin. But notice, even in that, Jesus commands. He says, "Bring me." Really subtly, he already shows who has the authority, who's in control. He's dictating the event. "Bring it to me." Means I'm in control. "Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" It's almost like he looks at the coin with disdain. And he says, "Oh, this trivial thing, this worthless thing, this blasphemous image, send it back where it came from. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." But he doesn't stop there. Then, while standing in the courtyard of the temple, that's where this takes place, right in the shadow of the temple. Standing in the courtyard of the temple, where these coins, they would be used to pay the temple tax, he says, "And give to God the things that are God's." This was a coin that would be used to pay the tax, the temple tax, the tax to God. He says, "Give that to Caesar and give to God what is God." You have been given coins with images stamped on them, but you yourselves are stamped with a far greater image. We have been imprinted with the image of God, and we are to offer ourselves to God. Heart, mind, body, soul. That's true worship. That's higher worship. That's what all worship is typological of, and that's what should inflame your passions. I mean, what does the Apostle Paul tell us in Romans 12? He says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Nobody could overtax you to the point where you couldn't give to God the things that are God's. It's impossible. They could strip it all away. It's all earthly. It's all fleeting. It's all fading. And Jesus is not going to get his blood pressure up over those things. That's a revolutionary way of fighting violence. That's a revolutionary way of fighting coercion. I'd like to present in closing three men, very briefly, who took the revolutionary way against coercion, against the state, who took the revolutionary way of fighting back. The first is a guy you're probably familiar with. His name is the Apostle Peter. 1 Peter 3:9. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. Peter takes a revolutionary road. A second man who took that same revolutionary road is a man by the name of the Apostle Paul. At the end of Romans 12, Paul says this, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Peter took a revolutionary road. Paul took a revolutionary road. And lastly, a man by the name of Jesus, he took the revolutionary road as well. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Peter, Paul, Jesus. They don't think politically like we do. Now, I want to be clear. I do not think that it is fair to say that Jesus is laying out an entire political theology here, because he is not. And that would not be fair. There is not enough to base a theology of church and state on here if this is all we have. But we need to let these words take root and do the damage that they should do. Ask yourselves even today, do I think like Peter? Do I think like Paul? Do I think politically like Jesus? In his crafty answer, he is certainly showing himself to be one who does not think politically like we do. And this passage, at the very least, it ought to relativize our passion. It ought to relativize our zeal with which we approach these things. We just saw Jesus, if you're reading through Mark's gospel, we just saw him really, really passionate about his Father's house. He's flipping tables. And that's the text that comes right before this. The temple mattered to him in an intense and personal way. And then here in the next text, he's like, let me see that coin. Give it to whoever it belongs. These stories being back to back in Mark's account, they ought to shape our priorities. They ought to shape where our priorities lie. So I'll leave you with this question to wrestle with. Where is your major contribution? What enlivens your passions? What sacrifice is a first priority in your life? That's the big issue of this text. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but render to God the things that are God's. Amen.